Svet podcastov Bauer Media. Bauer Media.
Welcome everybody. You are listening to podcast about architecture called How I Met My Architect. I'm Peťo Dostal. This podcast is usually in Slovak language, but thanks to the support of Culture Moves Europe and Goethe Institute, I could travel from time to time. And I came from Copenhagen. I spent 1 month in Copenhagen where I recorded 2 podcast episodes with Kobe Architects, with Adept Architects. And right now I'm sitting in Aarhus. In Denmark. So today I'm going to speak with Mikael Frost, one of the founding partners of Zebra Architecture. Hi, Mikael.
Hey.
Let me make a small introduction because I was working in a Zebra studio.
Yes.
10 years ago as an intern.
It's already been 10 years.
And I'm curious what we are going to talk about after 10 years. Let's warm up a little bit exactly with that question. I remember studio Zebra Architecture 10 years ago, which was, let me say, the size of 30, 40 people. Mm-hmm. You were just 3 partners. Today you are 4 partners.
Yeah.
And you sort of started to work abroad with international projects.
Correct.
So give us the small introduction, how the situation in Zebra have changed through those 10 years.
It changes so slowly and so gradual that you don't really notice, actually. I think it's not like we're more busy with more projects, but the projects are bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we are more people. But I think, I mean, ironically, if you look at the folders on the server, it's roughly the same amount of projects that we do every year, mm-hmm. but the size grows, so you need more staff to deliver on very big projects. But it means that, in essence, it's pretty much the same. I mean, there are more faces, of course, to remember and more people to work with, but I think it doesn't make that much of a difference going from 40 or 50 to 70.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I think there's like a threshold at maybe around 100. When you go beyond 100, something happens. And maybe you start having little like subcultures or departments or whatever.
But do you know everybody? Because 70 plus people, it's tough to know everybody.
This Saturday we had our summer party. And it's becoming a tradition to go to the Northside Festival with everybody from the office. And I learned that there was actually a couple of names that I forgot. That was a bit embarrassing.
But was there like interns or employees?
Actual employees, so it's a bit embarrassing.
That's a shame.
But I've looked it up now, and I was a little bit ashamed of it, actually. But I think it's natural. I was working in Schmidt-Hammer-Lassen. And we were growing a lot when I worked there. And I remember there was like a limit around 100. I actually stopped caring about the new people coming in, like getting to know them. And kind of the first time, oh, hello, how are you? And who are you? And then at some point you're like, yeah, whatever, there's another dude.
Mm-hmm, I'm busy. Exactly.
But it's around 100, as I recall it. And it's something I've talked to other people about, that there's like there's some point where you kind of, you stop not caring, but it's not important anymore to maybe know everybody, but I think I know everybody and I just forgot the names. It doesn't mean I don't remember the person. It doesn't mean I don't remember what we talked about and what we did. I was just a little uncertain about the name. Maybe it's because I'm getting old, actually.
So how comes that you remember me 10 years ago?
You know what? I actually think that the interns we had a long time ago, I remember better than the ones we had a couple of years ago. And once again, I'm not sure what the reason is, but that's...
Maybe you are getting older.
Might be it, because that's the last thing that goes for really old people is the faraway memories or the memories from way back. So, I don't know.
But that's exactly... I saw the size of the office, and for me, it was like 30, 40, but I... In a like Slovakian context, it's a very big office.
Yeah.
But I really sort of felt like a small family here.
Yeah.
So it's reachable, I think, the guys. And since you have the lunch every day behind the one big table, which I also really enjoyed, that could be a chance to talk.
That's one thing I've noticed, which is interesting, is that the interns are not coming up and talking to me anymore. And I've been wondering about that too. Maybe I'm getting too old.
Or too serious.
Or maybe the office is so big that they kind of feel that they need to talk to their first superior or second or like this, mm-hmm. like a military structure. Mm-hmm. But it's really a flat structure, and they can always come to me. And I enjoy talking to young people a lot. I try to, of course, reach out to them when I can, but okay. they don't come to me anymore. And they used to just walk up and talk and say hi and whatever, but that also changed a little bit.
Okay. So let me ask you how your role have changed through those years.
Actually, it hasn't changed at all, I would say. I mean, I guess I'm probably drawing less and instructing more.
Okay.
But that's natural. And when I was younger, I thought that I would kind of miss it if, when I got older, I would draw less and be in meetings and instruct people more. But I think it's actually okay. I mean, I've drawn tens of thousands of hours and thousands of plans and so on. I mean, I'm not I'm not full, I would say, but I don't have to work like that anymore. But I keep sketching, of course. That's super important to always do the hand sketches, and I do my sketchbook still and try to stay loyal to that way of working and so on. Mm-hmm. And that's, I would say, enough for me. But I still feel unfulfilled if I go home one day after and not having done a single drawing. I dislike that.
Okay.
I need a kind of a physical proof that I actually did some work.
Mm-hmm. I have.
Which is weird because being in a meeting is also work, and this is work actually in a way, but it doesn't feel like work. It only feels like work if there's like a product at the end of it.
Okay. But architecture is not only about drawing, but a lot of stuff behind.
Exactly. But that's what I do. I develop projects and I develop concepts and I work with the aesthetic part of architecture. And of course, you're absolutely right. That's just one part of it.
Yeah, I have some questions prepared for the Sidra yeah. tombs, yeah. which are the famous sketches.
Yeah.
So I hope we will. We can go through those questions later.
You almost can't do an interview and not talk about it in a way. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
You can be also tired of it.
No. I just did a master class of the whole idea of how I structure my artwork and my drawings.
Oh, where can I find it? Or where can we find it?
No, it's not online. It was a master class in a festival, an architecture festival in Tirana called Bread and Heart Festival.
Oh, in Albania.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, go check it out on Instagram or the internet. It's quite an interesting festival.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit. Can you share with me what is then at least your hardest part of your job now, or the most pressure which you could create for yourself, because that's the biggest pressure which we create.
Balancing everything and finding time for everything is difficult.
What does it mean, everything, in terms of work or also after work?
Yeah, also after work, actually, the whole sort of the whole package. Like if you go traveling for some days, you can't go cycling and exercise and stay fit. And if you're in too many meetings, it's difficult to get time to draw. And I mean, it's I have a very packed calendar, I think, sometimes. And that's the difficulty, that's balancing everything, because you want to do a lot of things, of course, because life is interesting. Architecture is interesting. You want to be part of as much as you can, but there's only 24 hours a day. So you really have to choose. So today, just before this meeting, I just sent an email turning down an invitation to be in a jury, which is a shame because I like to be in a jury. It's fun and educational to be in a jury, to be on the other side of the table and actually evaluate competitions coming in, learning a few tricks also from what you see and having a great discussion and so on. But I had to turn it down. It's just I can't do it that day. I can't make it. So, you know, that's the difficult part. And I think everybody would say the same, to have also the time to really think deeply for a while without interruptions, like without an email that you need to answer right now, or without somebody tapping your shoulder, like we have an issue on the billing side. All of this, the luxury time I would have earlier and also as a student, where I could sit around for hours and almost forget about my surroundings and just dive into like solving something.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of rare now, which is a shame. I really miss it.
So during the normal working day, mm-hmm. how much time do you have for yourself, or what is the period to focus 100% what you need?
I don't know on average how many hours I would say a day, but a lot of the time where I am alone I would be answering emails like minimum, I think I receive around 50 emails a day. I mean, if you take away like spam stuff that you can just delete. Yeah.
And relevant, 50
kind of
relevant.
Reading that or answering that is already quite a bit of work.
Yeah, for sure. And you never know how long the answer will take. But what is not shame, let me go back, what is not shame is it's learn to say no. It's really important how
It's one of the most important things to say no to both, well, to all sorts of things really, but particularly also commissions.
So do you think that you are able to say no now?
It's kind of funny because we don't have to say no too often. I mean, we do, but there's also been an automatic change where people will say, well, I've often talked to people who then said, we were going to ask you to do this, but then we thought, no, you're too, it's
too busy.
Not interesting enough for you because you're kind of on that level and it's like an ordinary project and it's a very low budget and blah, blah, blah. So maybe you wouldn't do it anyway, so we didn't ask you. And most of the time, they're actually right. It's something that we wouldn't want to do. Sometimes they're wrong and we're like, oh, damn it, you should have called us. An automatic response in the market where people kind of stay away from us with certain commissions. And then also people know you already that, okay, they know CIPA, we don't do hospitals. So we would never get contacted to be on a team for a hospital or anything like that. So,
and you would like to?
No, we would not like to at all.
Okay.
No way.
It's too complicated.
No, there's not a lot of room for form giving and for expression and design. Most of what you do in a hospital is logistics and technical facilities and like large user groups and so on. It's quite rare that you do a hospital like the one Herzog and de Meuron is doing now in Hillerød. Uh-huh. That's quite an unusual thing. Normally, it's a very unartistic discipline, I would say. So we deliberately didn't want to do that when, you know, like 20 years ago, there was like a lot of these super hospitals being rolled out in Denmark. And we decided immediately that we're not going to pursue it.
Okay.
Simply for this reason, that it's not a thing to do for an artistic office. That's our opinion. I can be wrong. Mm-hmm. And you could disagree, but that's our view on it. But anyway, in terms of saying no, and yes, we do turn down commissions. Like when Frederick started, who's our COO, he kind of looked at some of the stuff that we're doing. It's like, you're losing money here, you're losing money there.
Business.
Is this, yes, and is this bringing you forward? And we were like, well, actually, it's not bringing us forward. And so a lot of things we simply stopped doing. Like one thing that we did a lot in the early days is a kindergarten, which is a fantastic thing to do.
Yeah, I remember.
It's meaningful. It's fun. It's a great commission because you can do things that are a little, I would say, playful because it's almost expected from a kindergarten, right?
And client will accept that.
Yes. And so we quite liked it, but it's too much work, too poorly paid. And that's also kind of a fun learning, actually, is that the best commissions are also the ones that are paid the best. So if you do like a Guggenheim Museum, we haven't, but if you did one of those, I'm sure it's paid quite well. The great commissions also usually comes with a great fee. And so if you do something that's like, you know, like subsidized affordable housing, it doesn't come with a good fee, which is a shame, because it's a lot of work to do it and
there is not less importance.
To kind of twist a little bit of architecture out of a low billing budget, but there's no good fee for that either.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to do it even more.
Exactly. And what happens is that you end up spending a lot of time with it because, at least in our case, we cannot live with a poor result because we feel it will damage our name. So even if we have like a low budget project and we don't anymore that often, but if we do, we still try to make a piece of architecture. And so you overspend your time, and it takes away time and energy from other things that could kind of move you forward and up. So saying no is really, really important. I mean, I completely agree with you. I think there's a book out there called, what is it? Yes is More.
Okay, it's a quite old one.
Quite old one, but also a significant and very famous one. And no is just as important as yes, for sure, absolutely. But I think what happens is that when you just open your office, you need to have work, to have something to do and to pay your staff if you have staff. So you're kind of forced to say yes to basically everything. But then if you manage to kind of move up, you begin to find yourself in a position where you actually can say no. And of course, don't be arrogant about it.
No, it's not the
routine. It's not about that. You say, thank you for calling and thank you for thinking about us, but we are probably not the right architect for you, which is actually the truth.
But I would say it could be really setting the boundaries, because to not be overwhelmed, overworked with the stuff.
Also that, and for yourself, I think also when you're a young architect and you start out, you want to prove yourself. And so you want to do as many buildings as you can in a hurry. Mm-hmm. But then as you kind of get older, you find, oh my God, I'm going to be working for 40, 50 years. Why am I sprinting? Mm-hmm. I could actually slow down a little bit and do better work and not necessarily fast work. I'm not saying that the slower you work, the better it gets. That's not the truth. But I'm also saying that you can go too fast sometimes. And so having a more regular pace is better, and it will also make you last longer, I think, in the field of architecture.
Okay.
That you don't have to retire at the age of 50 because you've just done all-nighters all the time and so on. Mm-hmm. Some of my competitors, at my age, when I look at them, I think they look burned out. I mean, physically, I don't think they might not be burned out, but when I look at them, they look tired and unhealthy. And that's from all-nighters and from traveling and all of this. You have to be cautious. And I'm not a health guru in any way. I'm not really a health guru, but I still think that you kind of need to get your sleep and exercise and...
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you just started the big topic, very relevant. Yeah. This like burnouts, overload, over hours. It's a big issue in architecture.
Totally.
So let me ask
it's
you
almost
how...
It's like a tradition, isn't it? I mean, it's... Yeah.
Yeah, but how do you take care of your employees to avoid those situations? Because you also have the competition district, let me call it like this. And competitions, it means like deadlines, deadline after deadline, which you cannot avoid. So how do you take care of your employees?
I think the people in our office, they rarely do what we tell them to do. They do what we do. So we kind of lead them through example. I think... If I was very rude to people, I would create a culture of rudeness, and they would probably be rude to one another. If I'm kind to people, people will be kinder in the office. And so I think you're setting the example. And so we would be in the office late and in the night in the beginning, but not anymore. And our staff has developed with us, also because people stay a long time in our office, which is good. I'm proud of that. It's probably because they like to work here. And so... As we have stopped doing all-nighters and, I mean, we're not working less, I would say, but in a different way, they've done pretty much the same.
So there is no difference?
Sometimes, well, there is a huge difference. We work less in weekends and nights now than 10 years ago. Sometimes I miss the energy of doing the all-nighters and kind of, just giving it full gas. I kind of miss the energy of that and being a startup and... But I suppose it's also just like a natural process that you mature a little bit and your pace gets slower. Eventually you die, of course. I get really slow and then you die. So it's part of also, I mean, in general, as in your 20s, you are just a more energetic person and you can work till 11 o'clock and you can go to a bar and then you get up 4 hours later. You just can't do that when you're 55 physically. So that's also like a natural.
A lot of guys can argue with you. Most of them are singing and jumping on the stages.
Yes, but I know those people, and they don't get up in the morning. I mean, they will be late and stuff like that. And maybe they don't work too much anymore. Maybe they are more performing and instructing. Mm-hmm. So you can get the idea that, oh my God, these guys are really energetic, but that's just what you see. You don't see... What happens after the party? Yeah.
Totally.
I mean, there are a few superhuman guys out there that can just like poof, poof, keep going. Maybe Rem Koolhaas is one of them. I don't know. I don't even know. I don't know him. But normal people, normal people have to slow down.
I mean, I really remember the situations working back in Zebra that that was a really good example to me, because that time I was like after school, which you have these thoughts that you all the time working because or studying because the things they are never finished. And when I started to work here, there was like 5 o'clock. I stand up and there was no one in the office almost.
And that's already 10 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was really, really cool that I could see that example that is it possible to do it?
And people are super efficient while they are working.
Kind of.
That's one of the things I see in when I went to China or other places in the East, that they will be in the office basically all day and all night, but they're not working. They're kind of hanging out. They're not efficient. I mean, they're not actually producing anything that you can invoice.
But they think they are working.
They are at work, but they're not working.
Yeah, they are. But like in terms of the like mental heaviness,
you
think that, oh, I was in work, I was working, and you are not.
Believe you. No, you were not. Yeah. No, exactly. But I mean, I remember also from when I was in Smithhammer lesson, we did all-nighters all the time. That was a culture. It was definitely a culture. Also because we went from doing competitions twice a year, and then after the European laws changed and public tenders had to go out into competition, we did one every month. We kept the culture of a competition being like a special thing where you can do an all-nighter, and we started doing all-nighters every month, which is maybe twice a month, which is definitely unhealthy. And I learned a few things. One thing is that the decisions you make from around 12 o'clock until 6 o'clock in the morning, those decisions are quite bad. And also your pace, your speed, the speed at which you work completely slows down, not just for me, but for everybody. So it's a lot more efficient to have at least 4 or 5 hours and then start working, and you will easily catch up because you are much faster when you've slept. If you do not sleep, it's like in a way, your brain starts sleeping while you're awake, kind of. You can't really produce very fast. Mm-hmm. So you might as well sleep and be a little healthier and also be an architect in 10 or 20 or 30 years. So that's one thing I learned. You even though you're at the office and you're kind of sitting and working, it's so slow. It's unbelievable. And then after actually stopping in the office, I became quite ill. And I can't prove it. There's no science behind this, and I'm not a medical doctor, but I think it was a reaction to 5 years of work that was just way too much. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if I had kept doing that, I would probably not be in architecture anymore. So it's good to work hard. It's necessary to work hard. Architecture is fun, but you need to pace yourself. It's like if your entire career is like a marathon, you would never start sprinting the first 100 meters. I mean, you would never do that. You'll find a good pace that works for you.
Okay.
Works for your family, works for your health. That's the pace. And it also depends on who you are. Some people like to really speed up and then have like a couple of weeks where they don't really work. I like an even, pretty hard pace. That's what I like, to always work pretty hard and never really take off too much time. And other people like will work around the clock for a week and then they'll do nothing the next week, mm-hmm. and kind of recover. I don't like that. But that's a personality thing.
Yeah, everybody is different. But let me ask you, or let me connect the question, because 2 months ago I read an article about Bjarke Ingels.
Yeah.
About this situation, because there was like really strong article. I think you know what I'm talking about.
I never read about Bjarke, and I don't look at his work if I can avoid. It's difficult to avoid looking at his work, but I never do.
Why?
Because it's so strong and influential, and I don't want to be influenced by him. And it's very easy to look at his stuff and say, maybe you don't even think about it, you'll start drawing the same, because it's so powerful. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be a Bjarke copy. I want to find my own path. And you can't be a Bjarke copy, because he's a magician. He's amazing. He's like he's a total different species. He's not like the two of us. He's a different kind of an animal.
Okay.
So you can't copy the guy anyway. So I try to really avoid him. And also I think half of the stories about him is a lie anyway, because that's what happens when you become a celebrity. Everybody talks about you. We're talking about him now. Well, you actually started.
But, yeah, I started.
But anyway, but anyway, we're talking about him now because he's so powerful and influential and amazing. He's an amazing guy.
And do you know him personally?
Yeah, I know him personally. We're not friends. Like, I wouldn't invite him over for dinner. But he recognizes my face.
Oh.
At least. And he says hello to me and he remembers my name. That's enough.
Now you can die.
Yeah, now that's enough. But I wouldn't say that he's not a dear friend or anything. And I quite like him. I think he's friendly.
Yeah, but my question leads to, because there was
I didn't read the article.
Yeah, but the article was about, let me call it, slavery and really not unhealthy conditions in the office.
Yeah.
And like overnight, but a lot of people, it wasn't like just the one people complaining.
It was like a culture.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of. And I wouldn't say we are not going to argue that, but we can talk about that they were aware of it and they didn't do nothing about it because it looked normal, but it's not. He's sort of a star architect in the world. The question is if you are able to get to this position without that unhealthy environment.
Oh, you can get to that position. That's the fun thing about, I told you about the festival before that I was in Albania, and Bjarke also was there, of course.
Oh, okay.
There's no party without Bjarke. And I was there, and Calatrava was there, and Benedetta Tagliabue was there, and Kengo Kuma was there, and I can just keep, Pierre Demeron from Hestem was there. I can keep going. Funny thing is, when I was younger and I didn't move in those circles, I would think that all star architects were assholes, to be honest, and pardon my language. But it turns out they're as different as any other group of people. Some are super friendly, some are arrogant, some are annoying, some are charming, some are quiet, some talk a lot. I mean, it's all kinds of people. I believe it's not a general thing that to kind of reach the top you need to build a ship for slavery. Not at all. There are many ways to do it. There are many ways to be a brilliant architect. There are many cultures in the offices. It's quite fascinating, actually.
Yeah, it is.
It's so different.
But unfortunately, we don't know the environment, which will be like really nice in terms of working conditions.
It can also be too nice, I think. People get lazy when it's too nice. I know I sound like, I don't know what I sound like. It doesn't sound nice when I say this, but I've experienced a few times that you kind of give something to a person and they don't return the favor. Like, it's not like you experience people being grateful if you give them something that you don't have to give them.
Yeah.
And I don't expect people to be grateful all the time and thank me all the time. But I think it can also be too nice. Needs to be a little bit of a demand for excellence. When you ask for excellence, it has to hurt a little bit. It's like you can't become a good cyclist and win the Tour de France if you're not willing to suffer a little bit.
Mm.
But on the other hand, you can't suffer all the time. Then you will break down and collapse. And this is where I think some of these offices that are run like slavery, they just find a new soldier to put in. When one dies, you just put in another one.
Which is, it's like a war.
Which is horrible. Right? We want actually to last. We want our people to last. And we think it's the clever way to do it because they get better and better. They know how things are done here. And they are part of building a culture. And they can do projects on their own then after a while, we hope. That's much better than changing people as they collapse. So I don't even believe it's a super smart thing to do. It's not good to do, but you can be too kind.
But
if things are too kind, you can't deliver on the top level.
But that's what you are talking about. I think you need to care about the people. Because if you are like, if you are a partner in your studio, but you are living on a cloud, let me call it like this, and you don't know your people, you don't know your hierarchy, that could be the way how you can change your soldier very easy.
Yeah, no problem. But I think in a lot of these environments, the top general, the star architect, will care for the people that it matters to care for. So like your important people you will care for, like your colonels and your lieutenants, but not the soldiers.
Yeah, but you said it at the beginning that there is like a number of 100 people in your office, and that could be the boundary for you to don't care about the people. And imagine
that doesn't mean that you will have a bad culture. That if you reach a place where you don't remember people's names or you don't see them too often, or you never work with them because they're working with another partner, whatever, you can still have a nice culture.
Yeah.
And you can still have a decent culture where it's allowed, for instance, to say, listen, I can't work next week. My son is in the hospital or whatever. But it's still, you create an atmosphere and a culture.
Let me connect with one financial question, mm-hmm. because that's something what is also important to me. While I was in Denmark, I was talking with some architects about the salaries. I would like to ask you very honestly, if I will be like working in Sibra, I'm an experienced architect, I have 10 years of experience, okay? Mm-hmm. What is the, let me say, the range of the salary which I could earn here?
I don't even know, actually.
Thank you.
No, I don't do the, basically, and I know I sound like a spoiled child in a way, but basically I don't deal with money ever. I don't do the contracts.
Wow.
I don't do the salary negotiations and all that. But we have agreements, of course, with the union of the architects. And actually the salaries in Denmark are pretty regulated in a very old-fashioned manner within architecture, not in engineering. In engineering, it's completely free negotiation, but here you have like certain thresholds that you can kind of look it up. If I have 5 years of experience, I go to minimum this, 6 years minimum this, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like we call it a staircase. So you can go and look it up and find the rules and the agreed terms between okay. employers and employees. And of course, you can look up the average salary, but that's higher. Because you'll see probably the salaries from all of Denmark, and there are more architects in Copenhagen, they are paid higher than in Jutland because living expenses are higher. So the people we hire in Copenhagen are paid more than here.
Okay.
But I remember seeing one A4 sheet once in a meeting with the other partners with all of the salaries lined up from the highest one to the lowest, and I was actually quite shocked to see that the difference is very little. From low to high, which is kind of a communist type of thing, I guess, in Denmark. That it's, and even if you then consider the taxes, even less the difference. And also a fun fact, I'm not being paid the most. I'm not the highest paid, and the partners are not the highest paid.
Who is the highest paid?
I can't tell you her name. Now you're down to 50% chance of guessing. Because that would be unfair, of course.
Okay.
But it's not us.
I mean, let me ask you in a different way, on an example.
Yeah.
That when you are in Slovakia, you think that architects in Denmark, they earn a lot.
Yeah.
So, but when I was asking the guys who were working here for 10 years in a good architecture studios.
You were just with Kobe. They're not getting paid a lot in Kobe, I think.
But what those people said, I was sort of surprised because it was really similar that they said that they earn around, let me say, 50,000 krone.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Which is, okay,
that sounds about
it's like 7,000 euros. Let me count it to euros.
Exactly.
But you have the 40% tax, which means...
Minimum.
Minimum. Yeah. So which means that you have, you will get like 4,000 euros and then you need to pay for the rent.
Yeah.
Which is like even less.
Yeah.
And this is the breaking point for me, because then you have like 2 or almost 3,000 euros at the end, which could look a lot. But according to my experience, I see that everything here in Denmark is sort of like in terms of prices, like groceries and stuff, everything are like expensive, like twice or doubles.
Yeah.
So if I will divide this number by 2, it means that I'm an architect, let me call it in Slovakia, I have 10 years of experience, and I will earn 1,500 euros, which is not that high.
No.
So this is the math which I had to do here.
So what you are saying...
But it's a reality.
You are saying that architects in Denmark are well paid?
No.
No.
No, no, no.
And that's correct.
Not at all.
But I think we are paid better than, for instance, Spanish architects, who are being paid very, very little. But in society, if you look at other academics with long educations, architects are paid very, very badly compared to doctors, lawyers. We are definitely the ones that are being paid the least, and we work the most.
Yeah, exactly. Overnights. Because you see the vision, and the vision will take you in this toxic environment?
I talked to my little brother, who is not an architect, and he said, if I could just get the money that I get and not go to work, I would love that. I'd be like, what the fuck? I would go to work for free if I did. If money didn't exist.
You design projects to Russia, Canada, United Arab Emirates, Albania. Yeah. So those ones, what was the Zebra's motivation to actually design abroad projects? Mm-hmm. Because it's always connected with traveling, with a thing that you don't know the culture, like to keep the quality outside.
Yeah, there's a lot of risk involved.
Yeah, sort of. So why did you choose to design abroad?
Well, I can say two things. First of all, it kind of chose us in a way, but we also chose to work abroad. And when I say it chose us, it's because we were also contacted from abroad.
But that's when you can say no.
You could say no, we only work in Denmark. That's true. But I think there are many nice things about working outside of Denmark. One thing is that you get to do things that you could never do here. So you get work experiences that are just unique. For instance, we would never be doing a mosque in Denmark like we did in the UAE, where we did the Musala. And we would probably never be doing a Sam Ibrahim building that we did in Toronto. Because, for instance, here, the university is all, as you know, yellow brick and pitch roof.
Yeah.
That's it, which, by the way, is I completely understand. Or the school in Russia, the Irkutsk school, a school of that size would never happen in Denmark. So you get work experiences that are completely unique and makes your work life a lot of fun. And it means that you can kind of stay a student, which is nice because you have to learn. Every time you go to a new country, you have to learn. You have to study and find out what's the climate, what's the culture, what is the building technique. And you let the building technique inform the design that you do and so on. And I really find that interesting. I remember going to Abu Dhabi, which was one of the first times we really started working abroad, and I was just so inspired. It was like a saltwater injection. I was so inspired by the desert and the climate and the palm trees and the traditional tents and all of this. All of a sudden, I had a completely new vocabulary to work with that could inform the project. So that was extremely inspiring. A fun thing is that there are many architects in Denmark, and we are a small population. So architects per capita is quite high in Denmark. And also, there are many good ones. And so the competition in Denmark is fierce. And I would say that for us, at least, it's been way easier winning competitions outside of Denmark than in Denmark. Very, very difficult to win a competition in Denmark against Danish teams. If you go abroad, much easier. Like the project with the Kasserl Hossen that we won down there. I mean, even though it was esteemed names, the competition was very bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other schemes were quite bad, I would say. Something. I mean, and I think if we'd done the same competition against only Danish teams, the likeliness of winning would have been much, much lower. Absolutely. I'm not saying the foreign architects are bad. They're not under so much competition pressure as we are in Denmark because we're a small population with few buildings and many architects, and we follow the European laws to the clock. That if there's a public tender, it has to be a competition. I think in Italy and Germany and so on, they kind of get around it a little bit and they make like a fake competition with very little entry material, and they pick a winner. And quite often the winner is coincidentally somebody that's already been working on some early studies on the project, etc. And those guys would never even be in the competition in Denmark and so on and so forth. So the competition environment in Denmark is super tough.
Mm-hmm. It sounds unhealthy also when you compete for everything because
it's not unhealthy, but it's expensive. Mm-hmm. It's expensive, and the documentation level in Denmark compared. And that's another reason for going abroad. The documentation level in Denmark is ridiculous. It's so much you have to account for in a competition. You're almost designing like a schematic design project in a competition and not just a concept. Where in other countries, like if you take the Sam Ibrahim building, massive project, I don't remember the size of it, but it's something between 20 and 30,000 square meters.
That's a lot.
That competition entry was, as I recall, one render, a few diagrams, some text and some CVs, and that was it. all on A4, a package of, my guess, 20, 30 pages, and that's it. No massive plans with all of the toilets.
Because it was the first stage of the competition, I guess, and
there was the second stage. It was exactly what you submit in Denmark for a pre-qualification, and there you win the entire commission.
So you have also pre-qualification?
Yeah, but that was just like saying yes to an invitation. I'm telling you, I mean, okay. And also in Albania, the documentation you do for competitions or for, I mean, it's way, way, way less. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So for a fee that's, if you go to, let's say, Albania, the fee for a competition is higher and the documentation is lower than in Denmark. So it's very expensive to do competitions here. It's not unhealthy, really. It's such an expense.
Okay.
It never covers your hours at all, not even half of it.
Mm-hmm. But you are doing it for the future, I guess. But when you are saying that, when you are saying that designing abroad is a little bit easier for you, since you are used to...
Some things are easier, some things are more difficult. Yeah. It's more difficult to have it built the way you envisioned it.
Okay, so what is then the biggest challenge to design abroad?
The biggest challenge is to kind of, when you're in a country where you don't even speak the language and you don't know the politics and you don't know really anything.
Culture.
You will go to Abu Dhabi. You're in the hand of your AOR, and basically if they decide to like cut the connection, they can do that. They did actually in the Russian project in Yakutsk. All of a sudden we didn't hear anything anymore and we didn't know if...
But did you build the school in Irkutsk, right, in Russia?
I mean, we designed the competition proposal and we won the competition. And then we had an AOR in Russia working with us, doing sort of detailed plans and so on. And we had hoped for some peer reviews where you kind of comment and you send it back. But what happened is that they just stopped replying our emails and they stopped taking the phone when we called them. And we thought the project stopped. We thought that they weren't going to continue. And then I met one of the guys, actually, because I was at a venue in Kazan, like an architecture festival in Kazan. And I said, so what happened with the school? Because I was sure it just kind of stopped. And said, what do you mean what happened? Yeah, I said, but why was it terminated? It's terminated. We've already finished building it. We just needed you to deliver the baby, he said. Meaning we just need you to win the competition so that we could take over and win the entire fee for detailing and build it. And so that's what happened. And the school doesn't look the way it should.
No.
The columns are way too clunky. The roof is not the right shape, et cetera, et cetera. It looks decent. And I think we've even photographed it and also published it in one of our books. But it's not at all as sophisticated and delicate as it could have been if we had been involved the whole way through. So that's one of the dangers of working abroad, controlling the quality of your work. That's really difficult.
No, mostly when they cut you out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing you could do about it. What are you going to do about it in Russia? I mean, can't do anything, really.
That's true.
Yeah. It took off great, the project. They actually paid us the competition fee before we invoiced them, which is the first time ever. Before we actually sent the invoice, they just put the money in our account. That was a weird experience. That's not happened before.
Yeah, I would say that if you will meet with the guy, maybe they will bring you the cash.
Yeah, we've also been offered cash in some places. We can't really.
That's great. You shared the experience with the Russia project with me. But let me ask you about the Abu Dhabi project, Qasr Al Hosn.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because I was working on that project
exactly.
10 years ago, and I really remember, like, it's a site of the big public space with a cultural heritage building in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
And I remember that you won a competition and you beat a Snøhetta studio, very famous Norwegian architecture studio.
Yeah.
And I remember that after you won a competition with your design, you came back from the meeting with the royal family. We can talk about that later. And you had to start from the scratch.
Yeah.
What was the point to win the competition that time, or what happened?
It's happened to us a few times that we win a competition where none of the competitors, in this case, 9 international companies, none of the competitors actually made a design that was liked by the shareholders and the leadership.
But those big studios, everybody is able to handle the project in general.
Yeah. But they thought, and I agree with them, that none of us got it right. So of all 9 architects, none of them actually understood the site well enough.
So why they chose you?
Because they liked us the best, because of our presentation,
okay,
because of the way we had analyzed the site, and because of the way we present architecture. So partly because of my presentation and my presence and my way of talking about it, and the fact that I was drawing at my presentation and engaging with the client and being... I think they understood that we are the type of architect that will kind of listen to critique, take it in and rework it, whereas some architects will say, it's my way or the highway. I'm Jean Noël. This is what I do. If you don't like it, you know, you're out or whatever. I don't know if he's like that, but I could imagine. I don't know. I'm making up stuff.
Rumors.
Yeah, rumors. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, yeah, I admire their work, so I should, let's just get that straight. But anyway, so they liked us. So we won as a company. So you could almost consider it as like a dating process in a way, where the project became secondary as soon as the client learned, well, we don't like any of these.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with our scheme, and I didn't understand back then, but I definitely understand now, is that it was way too loud. It was way over the top. It was way too wild and too crazy. And I think this was our second project in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had the idea that, okay, we're in UAE, it has to be kind of wild and loud and Dubai-ish. And that's not what they want at all. In fact, the royal family is much more into something that's sophisticated and subdued, a little quiet and related to their heritage. They're very proud of their heritage and they want to kind of create a modern language that's unique to Abu Dhabi. And the scheme we proposed didn't do that. And also, practically, some of the, you remember the circular ripples we drew,
yes,
were even taller than the tower of the fort, which is in a way a no-go because the fort is supposed to remain the main piece of architecture on the site because that's where the rulers used to live for 100 years. It's one of the first buildings in Abu Dhabi and it's certainly one of the, if not the most important building. So you can't make it disappear behind an architect's wet dream of flashy shapes. We had to kind of tone it down, make it more subtle, make it more quiet. And today I don't understand that it took us so long to do that, that it took us so long to understand, but sometimes it's difficult to fully appreciate what your client wants. And also they are extremely polite. Whereas in Denmark, if you go to a meeting and say, I hate it, it has to be like this and like that, that one has to be red and you need to take that away. You'll get very clear instructions. From the client to the point where it can be rude, but it's not rude, it's just the way we are in Denmark. We say it out the way it is. And sometimes when you do that abroad, people actually find you rude, but that's just the way things play here. It's not a rude thing really, it's just very direct. And in Abu Dhabi, they're just the opposite. The client's very polite.
Okay.
Very, very kind and polite. And they will say it. Funny thing is that the overall concept, guiding the shapes and so on, with the diagonal through the site, creating two environments on the square, one triangle that's urban, one triangle that's the desert, that has remained throughout all of the different variations that we ended up doing before we finally nailed it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That means when you have
always the basis.
When you have the good base, it will lead you to the
exactly.
To the
it has
form.
A massive flexibility. So you remember the scheme did the competition. All of the ripples were on one side. Today, also all of the Vuonoi shapes are on one side, and the fort is placed on a kind of a flat plain of sand, mimicking the days of the desert.
I mean, that time I really enjoyed the shadows.
Yeah.
Which were
yeah.
created with the ripples.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's something what I'm missing there now, I would say. And
yeah.
when you imagine you have like 50 degrees outside,
yes. yeah.
I would welcome some more like shading
yeah.
systems there.
First of all, we have created shadow through pocket spaces with trees.
Mm-hmm.
So you go from shade to shade, but you can't go through the entire site being mm-hmm. shaded all the time, but you can kind of go from oasis to oasis, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then what also we've learned later is that in fact, people, they come out at night. As soon as the sun is down, and it's down early compared to up here in Denmark, it's down at around 6 o'clock. That's when people come out. I mean, of course you want shade, but all of the social life and the kind of the gathering in urban spaces that that happens after the sun has set.
Okay.
Anyway. Yeah.
Mostly in Ramadan, it has to be really tough when you don't eat, don't drink.
True.
Going from shade to shade to survive. Yeah. But okay, but what was the other experience with designing a project for a royal family, which you don't do every day?
No, I mean, for a period of time, I think we were like the number one architect for at least a part of the family. It's a large family, obviously, and I actually never met Sheikh Mohammed. We were working with his daughter, and she was the stakeholder on our projects. And it's just amazing. She was an incredible client, extremely smart, and also capable of comparing up to 7 or 8 variations of a concept and kind of picking and choosing, and always actually
in a good way,
in a really good way, and extremely appreciative of what we do and very polite. I always felt really I felt well in her presence. I think I've met less than a handful of people in my life with what you call star quality. It's such a cliche expression, star quality, but once you meet it, you know exactly, oh, this is what they're talking about. And she has that. She has star quality. She's an amazing person, extremely clever.
Okay. And wait, can you describe that quality when you said like less than mouthful?
Just the fact that she reads drawings so well demonstrates this, because she wasn't trained in architecture, and yet she reads drawings as well as an architect. That's unusual already. That's like if you're a musician and you hand a sheet of paper, a sheet of music notes to a person, and they just kind of read it with no formal training in music, that would be pretty amazing. That's what she does. But also she's very kind, very welcoming, always very generous and smiling, and she's asking about your family, and she makes you feel well immediately.
Okay.
Unbelievable. And it's so weird because I've had like small-time clients that treat you like shit. Because you think, oh, you're just an architect. You do what the hell I tell you, and so on and so forth. She's not like that at all. She's like thanking for the beautiful work, and I mean, it's just unbelievable. They just fly you down on business, everything paid for, and so on. And it's great. And it's such an honor to work on these fantastic projects, and she's thanking you, you know. And I'm like, no, I should be thanking you for this opportunity. Like, thank you for taking the time, as if I'm like...
So you are thanking for 10 minutes, but sometimes I try to relate to this, but let me ask you in a different way. Sometimes you could feel this sort of honesty that she will tell you, oh, everything is great, but step by step, she's going to change everything. So
no, that's not actually how it works.
I'm not...
Well, it did with... Well, the difference is she's not telling you what to do, but she's telling you it's not there yet. Some clients will instruct you what to do. They'll say, go home and make it black, then I'm happy. Some clients will do that. Oh, I don't like a round building. It has to be square. Go home and change it. Some clients will definitely do that. She never does that. Mm-hmm. But she guides you gently so that you come up with the right solution. And
which you are satisfied with.
Always, because we never show anything that we don't like. And in the end, I could see that she was right all along. Our first proposal was way too loud. It was out of scale. It was almost to the point of being a little respectless towards the old buildings. And I wouldn't say I'm ashamed of it now. I'm not. I mean, we did our best. We won the competition. That's fine. But
that's process.
But I'm kind of surprised that we were so far off, actually.
Uh-huh.
You know, we were quite far off. But
that's exactly when you are designing new stuff in a totally different culture.
You knew nothing.
You knew nothing.
We had been down there 5-6 times actually at the time when we were in that competition. So we knew something, but still not quite.
Zebra tunes.
Yeah.
The famous sketches.
There's no way around it.
Which everybody sort of admire and... The really funny thing for me is, let me start very, very funny, that nobody copy-pasted those ones, sort of. No, you are still original.
I never thought of that, but you are right. I think it's also a difficult thing to copy. That's probably the reason.
Okay. Why is it so difficult?
Because it takes
ages.
It takes ages to do them, and it takes decades to learn how to do it. It takes a long time. I mean, it's, now you ask an AI to do something, it gives you a result in 5 seconds that looks amazing.
Okay.
If you want to do a watercolor, you train for years to get it right.
Yeah, we are talking about watercolored sketches, to make a small description. Yeah. But are you doing it like really with the physical brush?
Yes. Actually, some people ask me, what software are you using? And it's not software. Everything is completely physical.
Really?
Yes, it's a pencil and it's, I mean, it's more mixed media now than ever. It used to be just a pencil and watercolor, but now I also add oils and acrylics and all sorts of things. It's all completely analog, no computer involved. Well, for scanning it, there's a computer involved when you scan it into so you can present it on the web page.
But when you are doing the let me go very detailed. When you're doing the watercolor stuff, how you do the like super strict boundary between colors?
That's easy. You just take the pen and you do it with a very firm hand. It's something you learn how to do.
Because the water on a paper can make the big mess.
That's one little trick, actually. If you use very thick paper, 300 grams or above, and you use quite a hard pencil to do your sketch, it will become an engravement. It'll be like a little dent in the paper. And that kind of will stop the water a little bit as a kind of a barrier.
Okay.
You can't go fast. You still can't go super fast, but you can kind of stop it there. And that's one way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing those sketches before the project or after?
I also do color sketches sometime in the process, but those are more rough, I would say. Actually, what you refer to as the zebra tunes, that's like a full stop. When we've decided on the concept, we've handed over the competition, and this is kind of it, then it's nice to make a kind of a resume on one piece of paper summing up the idea of the project, which will then become a guideline throughout the detailed design process. You kind of go back, what's the essence of the project? That's all encapsulated in that one A4 piece of paper. But sometimes I don't get around to doing it. Then I actually do it even after the building is built. So it's also a communications tool. When you present the actual project, that could be on your web page or in a university, you can get an idea and appreciation for the idea before you see the images. So it's a way to explain architecture.
Yeah, definitely.
Through combining sequential art, a name coined by Will Eisner, sequential art, and you combine the imagery with text. And I've had people saying, I didn't understand the drawing until I started reading the text. That's people outside of architecture. Architects get it immediately. But like, for instance, the copy editor of one of our zebra files, she was like, I didn't understand until I started reading, because she's a words person.
Yeah, yeah.
It works with text. The text together with the drawings is a super powerful thing, which is what you see in comic strips, of course. So it's a communication tool, and it comes from the fact that a lot of academics in architecture, they speak a secret language that people outside of architecture don't understand. They use slang, architect slang, and difficult words. They have references that nobody knows about, but like a little elite. We find it quite nice to use a simple language that most people would understand, and also that our clients actually do understand and appreciate how we arrived at an iceberg, for instance, et cetera, et cetera. And so also this way of communicating is kind of dumbing it down, so to speak, to the point where we bring as many people on board as possible. We quite like that architecture should be inclusive and not elitist. I see in the architecture can be very elitist. And when I read some of the stuff that's, for instance, on the architecture school here in Aarhus, I simply don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you one thing.
Please.
I tell you one thing that I know. I'm not stupid. And I don't understand what they're writing. So it's not me. Those people who cannot communicate well, that's the problem.
Yeah.
And maybe they don't even know what they're saying themselves. And that's another good reason for doing these drawings. If you cannot do them, it's because your project sucks. That's because you don't have a strong and clear idea.
For sure,
If you cannot explain it in a simple diagram, that's because you don't probably really know what you're doing.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about beautiful drawings and technically advanced drawings. I'm just talking about like a regular fast, sketch that you'll be doing every day.
Yeah, I totally can relate to this, that I'm an architect and sometimes I don't understand what the other architects are saying. So how could the normal people?
It's an incredible arrogance. I should get over it because I'm 54 now. I should get over it, but it really makes me angry. I think it's so provocative when they're speaking their like gibberish, blah, blah, blah. And they're not really saying anything, but except for a lot of fancy words. It's kind of a show off. It's like a dictionary show off, but there is no content behind it. It's like empty smoke. I hate it. You're not only wasting your own time, you're also wasting my valuable time. I have to sit and listen to this shit. Mm-hmm. What are you saying?
But exactly after this meeting, you have the smoke in your head and you don't understand what.
No.
What? Yeah, I totally agree. But now we are talking about zebra tunes.
Yes.
I really recommend to the listeners to Google zebra tunes to just see what we are talking about, because you need it. Because it's very complicated, very nice and colorful. So now we are talking a little bit detailed about those ones. How you do the layers?
Of
the sketch, because when I see the, when you are saying, or I mean, I thought that you would say that you do something in with a computer, but now when you are saying you are everything do physical, what about the mistakes? When you will do the mistake with some lines, and you really have like, let me call people or something, you are sort of on the top. There is so much stuff in the drawing that you need to think in the layers. You need to think in the layers.
You are asking two questions, I suppose. One is dealing with mistakes.
And sorry.
No, that's fine. It's fine. I'm just trying to make sure that I get it right. And the one is dealing with mistakes. The other one is handling all the layers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Two questions
okay,
for you.
Okay, so the mistakes, first of all, the watercolors in particular, those are with pencil. I have a rubber. If I draw it wrong, I rubber it out and I draw again. I don't erase that much because even when you erase, you will see the dent in the paper because I pressure quite hard. So there's a limit as to how much you can do it. And a lot of the mistakes I do, that becomes, for instance, if I'm drawing with ink that I cannot erase, that becomes a chance to make a little improvisation. So if you make a line that's wrong, it's not going in the right direction, you disguise it as something else. You turn it into a tree, or you turn it into a cloud, or whatever. You can always make a little trick to make it look right. And also, I would say, in some sketches, a mistake actually can look nice, and that's what makes it look handmade. But you're right, when it comes to watercolor, you can only go darker and darker and darker. If you put on a color that's too dark, there's no way you can make it lighter. I mean, you can re-wet it and suck up some of it with tissue, suck out some of the color. That is possible. And for the layers, I draw it the way you read it. So that's from the upper left to the right, like writing. So imagine you do a square in the top. The next layer or the next drawing you draw, you just draw under that. Just stops from that.
Uh-huh, so you draw
the first one here, the next one under, the next one under, the next one under. Then it looks like layers, but it's starting from the top.
But then you have to draw the people at first.
Yes. Of course.
Really?
You have to know a little bit. If you draw a square and you don't want the line to cut through a person, you have to, of course, draw the person.
But you don't know where the people will be.
Well, you don't draw all of the people first, but for the one part of the drawing, let's say your overall composition consists of five shapes, and you start with one of those shapes. And with that shape, you draw the person first. Mm-hmm. But that's easy. Like, if I draw a person first, then I draw a circle around it, then you have a person standing on a circular plaza. That's easy.
Okay.
You draw the person first, and then you kind of...
Uh-huh, just one person?
Yeah, and then, then you add a couple of others that doesn't touch the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or is outside of the line. It's all about the order. It's really...
I can imagine. I'm just asking because it's a magic.
No, but I think it's a good question because you're right that in the end, there's a lot of detail and so on, at least with my older sketches I'm doing.
It's crazy complicated. Crazy.
Artistic, I would say.
Cool.
Yes, you're saying it's complicated, but the message, though, to understand what it's saying is easy, right?
Yeah.
The number of details and the colors, oh, yes, that's complicated. Like looking at a brick wall, there are many lines, many shades, and so on. But in fact, the system is easy to, or the message is easily understood.
What is the format? What is the form? A4, A3?
It's always portrait, like a high one, never horizontal, always high.
Okay.
All of the sketches are like literally I've done thousands of sketches. I actually calculated it to be something like half a kilometer of drawings or something put together. It's always high format. Well, the sketchbooks are actually 19 by 25 centimeters, and the watercolors are A4, so that's 21 by 29.7.
So how long does it take to you?
I used to say 4 hours for one.
4 hours?
Yeah.
It's nothing in terms of
No, that's
of
true.
The...
That's very, yeah, it's difficult to crank in, put in 4 hours. But that's because 10 years ago, I would never leave a watercolor and come back the next day. I would always finish it. I've begun now to kind of leave it half done and come back, which is nice. It's less stressful. It's very stressful that you've decided that you want to finish. Once you start, you have to finish. It's very stressful. So I don't do that anymore. I would usually just do it in one go to make sure this is it. This is
now you see how you grew up. You can say no to yourself
also
and come back later.
Yes.
That's what you should learn from this podcast.
Yes.
We are going to the finish.
Yeah.
So let me ask you the last question,
yeah,
which is a little bit different, but connected to the Danish society.
Mm-hmm.
I was asking the foreigners, mm-hmm, who are living in Denmark for a couple of years. Not everybody is an architect. And everybody is saying the same answer in terms of Danish society, that they want to build deep relationships with the Danish people, and they are not able to.
No,
they see sort of a barrier there.
I've heard that a lot.
You are very polite, very friendly, yeah, but when you come to this point, they don't feel that accepted with the Danish society. You already said that you are kind of aware of it.
Yes.
Can you brainstorm with me what could be the reason of it?
I actually think that it's not about being foreign. I think grown-ups, at least in Denmark, I mean, I'm generalizing, but a lot of us don't add new members to our circle of friends. So it's not only about being a foreigner, it's about becoming anybody's friend. Also, as a Dane, you have your kind of your group of friends from architecture school, and that's pretty much it. You rarely invite in kind of new people. It's difficult making friends in Denmark for everybody. It's not only foreigners. I assume it's probably even harder because you don't have the language and all,
mm-hmm,
that. But,
yeah,
but it's for everybody. So it's not a deliberate exclusion of foreigners, I think. Not at all.
Hmm.
And I remember we had an intern from Mexico, Paula. She said to me, listen, whenever I ask Danes to go out, like, let's go out for a drink, they're like, let me see in my calendar. No, Thursday is not good. Friday is not good. Maybe I can squeeze you in Sunday morning. No, wait a second. My husband is... Okay, in 2 weeks, we can have a drink. And she's like, come on. Like in Mexico, we just like, mm-hmm, decide to go and we go.
But is it like it? That you have like totally full calendar?
It's totally like that. As soon as you are around 30, 35, you're picking up kids and you're painting the house and,
okay,
you're looking after your parents. Uh-huh, and it's
so,
just... And
so
end your work, mm-hmm, your career, chop, chop, chop. If you're a student, of course, you can do all of that, no problem.
But so you are saying...
That's what I started saying, like, when you're an adult.
Okay.
After architecture school, you become an adult, you rarely... I think people rarely invite in. I mean, some will, but rarely you don't invite in new friends, Danish or foreigners. But then I think you're also right that that's the other reason, I suppose. We are also more reserved. I mean, I was just in the Bretton Hart in Tjärna, and I can see all the Spanish people, they are kissing on the cheeks, and then you're like,
Reserve.
And they talk a lot, and they're loud, and we're all like in the corner, kind of like, we are a bit shy, that's correct.
Okay.
And it's not because we dislike foreigners, actually.
Let me finish the podcast with these really nice thoughts about the Danish society. Thank you very much, Mikael, that you found the time for me and we could sit
and
chat.
It was a pleasure. It was fun. I enjoyed it a lot. It's really great to see you again.
Thank you very much. And thanks you shared also your opinions about the Zebra, about the Danish architecture and everything. It's very valuable, I would say. So thank you very much again. I hope to see you in the next 10 years again or something.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see what happened. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Let's make that... Let's make that appointment already.
Cool. To our calendars.
Yeah. Good point.
Because it's not.
We better pencil it in now. Otherwise, we can't do it. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Cool.